Monday night travel. I had an extraordinary experience over the Christmas break. I had a little time in Papua New Guinea. I spent a little time in Milne Bay and Alatau and just experienced a little of the local culture. It was fantastic. We tonight are going to experience that a little further and the nearby Solomon Islands. Rod Imey is a freelance travel writer, photographer, contributes to a lot of magazines, newspapers, websites around the country. And he has spent about a month there in total, having a look at the whole region, right down as far as New Caledonia. He joins us in studio to have a chat about Melanesia. How are you?
Great, thank you, Tony. Thanks for the invitation to come back.
Good to see you. Now, this is a fascinating part of the world. A lot of people, when you talk Papua New Guinea, get a little bit nervous about Moresby. It has a bit of a reputation, and in fact, it's something to be a little wary of.
Well, there's no getting away from that, Tony, unfortunately. Port Moresby, it's the international hub for the airlines, so you've got to go through there. But, you know, you get a taxi from the hotel, from the airport to your hotel, and you just be careful. I mean, it's the old lesson, you just got to be careful about your personal security. And as I've told people, there's only a couple of places in the world that I'm really afraid of, and one is my local railway station. So,
yeah, understood.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say the difference is dramatic in Alatau. People are very friendly, very warm, very hospitable, very welcoming.
Well, I think that that contrast exists pretty much everywhere else in Papua New Guinea, and it's Moresby and one or two other places that are the exception. So everywhere that I travelled, as far up as Rabaul and across to the Sepik River and Madang, and the so many of the little outlying islands that I can't count them all, were just fantastic.
Yeah. Now, you've cruised on a ship that's relatively modest in size, but it allows you to get in and out of small places.
Well, the ship that I travelled on, and that was the Oceanic Discoverer, is pretty typical of the vessels which are going there in increasing numbers now. And the companies are developing itineraries in conjunction with local operators, so there's a good amount of revenue going back to the villages and to local operators. And the Papua New Guinea Tourism Authority have been getting behind this in quite an encouraging way. And, there's, I think, probably at least a half a dozen vessels and who operate there with some regularity. And there's another, at least that many, that come through on parts of round-the-world cruises. I think your vessel was a similar one.
Yeah, I was on Silver Whisper, and it went in for a day or two, and then we went back to the Australian coastline, and it was great. But it's only about 200 passengers, so it's not very big.
I think that's ideal. You don't really want to get bigger than 200 passengers, because you can imagine that if you turn up in one of these huge big vessels and everybody gets off and this is tiny little village, the villagers would be completely overwhelmed. You wouldn't know where they were.
Oh, absolutely. And even from the friendly welcome, they do a traditional welcome for you, all dressed up in war paint and looking a little bit scary, but
yeah,
it's good.
They do. I just enjoy that so much. I mean, people that have been to Fiji, and the Fiji people are a Melanesian race as well, will know that the sort of thing they put on for you at the wharf and in town, and that's become a little trite and a bit commercial, hasn't it, Tony? So what you're seeing, I think, is the raw, unadulterated village exuberance that these people maintain. And if you're on a ship which you've got, less than 100 passengers perhaps, you go ashore and you're in a very manageable number and you've got a really enriching, intimate, personal experience with the people.
Yep. The kids, I notice, are very happy and very healthy. And that's an important factor, isn't it, you've got a community like that?
That's something that stays with us. As a parent myself, I've got two teenage kids, and I think, what a full-on job it is to keep them occupied and happy. And I'm sure many of your listeners will sympathise with that. But there you are, you're surrounded by mobs of little tykes all jumping and screaming and skipping, dancing around you. And you think, these kids are all so happy and healthy. They're eating food that's grown in their own gardens. They're catching fish and crayfish and stuff from the sea. And they are genuinely uncorrupted and healthy. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's a bit like stepping back to the 19th century in some ways. The cooler trading is certainly one big factor, and it's a bit of fun too.
Well, I tell you what, it's a very complex and complicated thing. Luckily, we had an anthropologist travel with us on Oceanic Discoverer, a lady by the name Nancy Sullivan, who's based in Madang, and she was so helpful because we wouldn't have had a clue what was going on. It's so complex and so subtle, the nuances of the trading. What will happen is you've got villagers from one island who will load up their cooler canoe, and these are quite substantial canoes, they're ocean-going canoes, and they're beautifully decorated and full of sorcery and magic. Mm. And they'll load up all their stuff and a lot of shell jewellery and produce, and they'll sail off to the nearby island, and they'll have this wonderful festival. There'll be parties every night, there'll be all kinds of frivolities, and they'll trade and they'll swap, and you'll see some of these incredible, intricate ceremonial jewellery, which is called cooler, mm. and crocus shells and things, and they're incredibly
ornate
and intricate, and they're hundreds of years old, some of them, and they've been passed down and down and down. You don't own them, you trade them. And, yeah, it's a sign of status and skill.
Now, obviously, this particular area is terrific if you're a scuba diver fanatic. There is plenty of opportunities, and, in fact, it's probably some of the best in the world.
Well, in some respects, it certainly is. I mean, it's very hard to beat Australia's Great Barrier Reef for natural beauty. But then, again, you've got so many of the war wrecks that are scattered all the way through Papua New Guinea and all the way across to the Solomon Islands. If I can bring the discussion over to Gizo in the Solomon Islands, which was part of one of the itineraries that I was travelling on. Gizo, of course, has been in the news lately because it's all but destroyed at the moment from the last cyclone. But some of the diving around there is fantastic because you've had a lot of activity during the Second World War, and there's entire ships.
Well, there's also that speculation about the World War One submarine from Australia, that was, I think, lost very near Rabaul, and the search for that has been going on.
I think that was called the AE-1. Was that right, Tony?
That's exactly it.
AE sister ship, the AE-2, sunk in the Dardanelles as part of the Gallipoli campaign. Yes, now it was sailing up to get rid of the German garrison in Rabaul, and just disappeared.
Well, they think they know where it is, but it's obviously a difficult search because it's quite deep water. It's a colourful area, and as we suggested, some of the natives are friendly, but in the past, some of the,
cannibalism, Tony.
Yeah, I think I was about to say some of their opponents didn't find them that welcoming.
Well, it was, you know, the cannibal. We talk about the Melanesian race for one reason or another have practiced cannibalism historically, and it wasn't that long ago that they stopped. In some areas, it was almost an honour to be eaten by some of these tribes. They would,
I would have seen that.
I don't quite have the attraction, but yeah, no, it was quite a ceremony. Quite a ceremony.
There's also a little bit of history too. While we're talking about wrecks, the PT-109 is a little bit part of American naval history, and a lot of people will know that, of course, President John Kennedy was on that ship when it went down. And that was just near Gizo, wasn't it?
It was, very close to Gizo. In fact, there's a lot of the dive industry there feeds off that legend quite unashamedly. And PT-109, which was a patrol boat, not unlike the patrol boats the Australian Navy currently use, although a lot more modern, of course, but the PT-109 was on patrol duty out of Gizo in one of the channels nearby, and well, the legend has it that a high-speed Japanese destroyer, which were currently resupplying Guadalcanal in the middle of the night, didn't see the PT-109. Whether they were asleep at the wheel on the boat is another story, but bang, it was a collision. PT-109 was split in two and went down immediately, but the chaps, including the future president, hung onto the wreckage and swam ashore to a little island there, which is now known as Kennedy Island. And, the story is told with, you know, great gusto, time and time again.
Mm. Now, Tanner Island is also something that is worthy of a mention.
Oh, Tanner's a fantastic place. It's if you continue southward towards New Caledonia, we're into Vanuatu now, and a lot of people who've been on traditional cruise vessels would have had a day excursion onto Tanner, and it's one of the few cooperative and genuinely accessible active volcanoes. You go ashore in a boat, there's a fleet of pickup trucks ready to take you up the mountain
yeah.
and various states of repair, and they don't actually change the tyres. They just wait till they blow and then they put another one on. But anyway, we're going up the mountain and you can hear the sound of this volcano. It's every 15 or 20 minutes it'll just have an eruption. Yes.
Forgive my impersonation.
And we got there and we were escorted to the top and there's this cloud of haze of smoke hanging in the caldera of this active volcano. It's interesting because the first thing you notice when the eruption is imminent is you see a shock wave through the smoke. And just like, just like a shock wave, exactly what it is. And then a second or so later you'll hear the sound and then you'll feel it. And then this is an God almighty explosion and there's stuff flying around everywhere and then it stops and then in the quiet aftermath you just hear plop, 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 as these patties of lava hit the ground around you.
Yeah. No wonder we're a little bit scared of tsunamis. This whole area is a little bit of a fault line, isn't it?
Well, it is. Scary. It is part of that Pacific Ring of Fire, which has got numerous volcanoes all the way around the edge and extends all the way around Hawaii. And we talked about Hawaii once before, I think, Tony, didn't we? We talked about the volcanoes up there. And so even then, the attraction of that kind of spectacle is enormous, and I found it thoroughly exciting.
A lot of people suspect that if you're doing island hopping, it's not too, exciting. You know, one island looks like the next, but everything has, its individual style about it.
Well, look, that kind of adventure that I undertook is not going to appeal to everybody. Some people will want to get on the big vessels with 3,000 other people and stand in queues all day at the all-you-can-eat buffet. That's not for me. We had these beautiful boats, 50, 60, 100 people on them at a time, excellent food, good service, and, everything else. And we... the comparison between the islands, I think everyone has got its own personality. They've got some of them are a little more commercially aware. They're a little more choreographed with their performances and they've got the souvenirs and everything laid out for you. It's like the kind of things you might remember from Fiji with the very aggressive traders that you've got on the wharf sets. None of that. I mean, there's a little bit of bargaining, but none of that kind of really aggressive haggling that you get in some places.
But the authentic Melanesian experience.
Oh, yes, it is. I mean, a little bit of haggling is mandatory, but then it becomes, well, that's it, and, either you're going to buy it or you're not. But the handicrafts are fantastic. I mean, people will know that, particularly the Sepik River, handicrafts are world-renowned, absolutely world-renowned for their beauty and their colour. And as you travel between each island, you are investigating slight nuances and changes in the Melanesian culture. I mean, for example, take the Trobriands as a completely standout example. Just north of where you were in Alatau, these people are just the most colourful and exuberant, and they're a very beautiful people, Tony. The men and women are just so handsome, and they put on a wonderful show that it's quite a spectacle. It is really quite a spectacle, and I can't possibly do it justice with words on the radio.
Yeah.
But anyone who will see pictures of the or video of the Trobriand Islanders will know what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Far from the mass market experience, Rod's been talking about a trip that basically takes you north of Australia to Papua New Guinea, through the Solomons, and down to New Caledonia, and a wonderful Melanesian experience. Thanks for telling us about it.
My pleasure, Tony.
Rod Imey, and if you would like to read a little more of his blog, you can, www.travography.com.